Often it's all she can do to keep from moaning herself at each of his grunts of pain, two voices in a dissonance which would be much less accidental than it sounded. Some nights she's gagged him with a ceremonial sash, bound him with a gold-tasseled fourragère or his own Sam Brown. But tonight he lies humped in the floor at her feet, his withered ass elevated for the cane, bound by nothing but his need for pain, for something real, something pure. They have taken him so far from his simple nerves. They have stuffed paper illusions and military euphemisms between him and this truth, this rare decency, this moment at her scrupulous feet. No, it's not guilt here, not so much as amazement, that he could have listened to so many years of ministers, scientists, doctors, each with his specialized lies to tell, when she was here all the time, sure in her ownership of his failing body, his true body, undisguised by uniform, uncluttered by drugs to keep from him her communiques of vertigo, nausea, and pain, above all, pain. The clearest poetry, the endearment of greatest worth. He struggles to his knees to kiss the instrument. She stands over him now, legs astride, pelvis cocked forward, fur cape held apart on her hips. He dares to gaze up at her cunt, that fearful vortex. Her pubic hair has been dyed black for the occasion. He sighs and lets escape a small, shameful groan.
"Ah, yes, I know," she laughs. "Poor mortal brigadier, I know it is my last mystery."
Stroking with fingernails her labia,
"you cannot ask a woman to reveal her last mystery, now can you?" "Please, no, not tonight. Kneel here and take what I give you."
Despite himself, already a reflex, he glances quickly over at the bottles on the table, the plates, soiled with juices of meat, hollandaise, bits of gristle and bone. Her shadow covers his face and upper torso. Her leather boots creak softly as thigh and abdominal muscles move, and then, in a rush, she begins to piss. He opens his mouth to catch the stream, choking, trying to keep swallowing, feeling warm urine dribble out the corners of his mouth and down his neck and shoulders, submerged in the hissing storm. When she's done, he licks the last few drops from his lips. More cling, golden clear, to the glossy hairs of her quim. Her face, looming between her bare breasts, is smooth as steel. She turns.
"Hold up my fur."
He obeys.
"Be careful. Don't touch my skin."
Earlier in this game, she was nervous, constipated, wondering if this was anything like male impotence. But thoughtful pointsman, anticipating this, has been sending laxative pills with her meals. Now her intestines whine softly, and she feels shit begin to slide down and out. He kneels with his arms up, holding the rich cape. A dark turd appears out the crevice, out of the absolute darkness between her white buttocks. He spreads his knees awkwardly until he can feel the leather of her boots. He leans forward to surround the hot turd with his lips, sucking on it tenderly, licking along its lower side. He is thinking he's sorry. He can't help it, thinking of a Negro's penis. Yes, he knows it abrogates part of the conditions set, but it will not be denied. The image of a brute African who will make him behave. The stink of shit floods his nose, gathering him, surrounding. It is the smell of Pasandala, of the salient. Mixed with the mud and the putrefaction of corpses, it was the sovereign smell of their first meeting and her emblem. The turd slides into his mouth, down to his gullet. He gags, but bravely clamps his teeth shut. Bread that would only have floated in porcelain waters somewhere, unseen, untasted, risen now and baked in the bitter intestinal oven to bread we know, bread that's light as domestic comfort, secret as death in bed. Spasms in his throat continue. The pain is terrible. With his tongue he mashes shit against the roof of his mouth and begins to chew thickly now, the only sound in the room. There are two more turds, smaller ones, and when he has eaten these, residual shit to lick out of her anus. He prays that she'll let him drop the cape over himself to be allowed, in the silk-lined darkness, to stay a while longer with his submissive tongue straining upward into her asshole. But she moves away. The fur evaporates from his hands. She orders him to masturbate for her. She has watched Captain Blissero with Gottfried and has learned the proper style. The brigadier comes quickly. The rich smell of semen fills the room like smoke.
"Now go.
He wants to cry, but he has pleaded before, offered her, absurdly, his life. Tears well and slide from his eyes. He can't look into hers.
You have shit all over your mouth now. Perhaps I'll take a photograph of you like that, in case you ever get tired of me.
No, no, I'm only tired of that, jerking his head back out of D-wing to encompass the rest of the white visitation. So bloody tired.
Get dressed. Remember to wipe your mouth off. I'll send for you when I want you again.
Dismissed. Back in uniform, he closes the cell door and retraces his way in. The night attendant is still asleep. Cold air hits Pudding like a blow. He sobs, bent, alone, cheek resting a moment against the rough stone walls of the Palladian house. His regular quarters have become a place of exile, and his real home is with the mistress of the night, with her soft boots and hard foreign voice. He has nothing to look forward to but a late-night cup of broth, routine papers to sign, a dose of penicillin that Pointsman has ordered him to take to combat the effects of E. coli. Perhaps, though tomorrow night, perhaps then. He can't see how he can hold out much longer. But perhaps, in the hours just before dawn... The great cusp, green equinox and turning, dreaming fishes to young ram, water sleep to fire waking, bears down on us. Across the western front, up in the Harz in Bleicherode, Werner von Braun, lately wrecked arm in a plaster cast, prepares to celebrate his 33rd birthday. Artillery thunders through the afternoon. Russian tanks raise dust phantoms far away over the German lees. The storks are home, and the first violets have appeared. At the white visitation, days along the chalk piece of seacoast now are fine and clear. The office girls are bundling into fewer sweaters and breasts peeking through into visibility again. March has come in like a lamb. Lloyd George is dying. Stray visitors are observed now along the still forbidden beach, sitting among obsolescent networks of steel rod and cable, trousers rolled to the knee or hair unsnooted, chilly gray toes stirring the shingle. Just offshore, underwater, run miles of secret piping, oil ready at a valve twist, to be released and roast German invaders who belong back in dreams already old, fuel waiting, hypergolic ignition that will not come unless now as some junior bureaucratic rag or May uprising of the spirit, to Bavarian tunesmith Karl Orff's lively O, 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 totus florio, jam amore virginali, totus ardeo. All this fortress coast alight, Portsmouth to Dungeness blazing for the love of spring. Plots to this effect hatch daily among the livelier heads at the white visitation. The winter of dogs, of black snowfalls, of issueless words is ending. Soon it will be behind us. But once there, behind us, will it still go on emanating its hooded cold, however the fires burn at sea? At the Casino Hermann Göring, a new regime has been taking over. General Wyverns is now the only familiar face, though he seems to have been downgraded. Slothrop's own image of the plot against him has grown. Earlier, the conspiracy was monolithic, all-potent, nothing he could ever touch. Until that drinking game and that scene with that Katya and both the sudden goodbyes, but now... Proverbs for paranoids. 1. You may never get to touch the master, but you can tickle his creatures. And then, well, he is lately beginning to find his way into one particular state of consciousness, not a dream, certainly, perhaps what used to be called a reverie, though one where the colors are more primaries than pastels. And at such times it seems he has touched and stayed touching for a while a soul we know, a voice that has more than once spoken through research facility medium Carol Eventier, the late Roland Feldspath again, long co-opted expert on control systems, guidance equations, feedback situations for this aeronautical establishment and that. Seems that for personal reasons, Roland has remained hovering over this Slothropian space through sunlight whose energy he barely feels and through storms that tickled his back with static electricity, has Roland been whispering from 8 kilometers, the savage height, stationed as he has been along one of the last parabolas, flight paths that must never be taken, working as one of the invisible interdictors of the stratosphere now. bureaucratized hopelessly on that side as ever on this. He keeps his astral meat hooks in as well as can be expected, curled in the sky, so tense with all the frustrations of trying to reach across, with the impotence of certain dreamers who try to wake or talk and cannot, who struggle against weights and probes of cranial pain that it seems could not be borne waking. He waits, not necessarily, for the aimless entrance of boobs like Slothrop here. Roland shivers. Is this the one? This? To be figurehead for the latest passage? Oh, dear, God have mercy. What storms, what monsters of the ether could this Slothrop ever charm away for anyone? Well, Roland must make the best of it, that's all. If they get this far, he has to show them what he knows about control. That's one of his death's secret missions. His cryptic utterances that night at Snoxall's about economic systems are merely the folksy everyday background chatter over here, a given condition of being. Ask the Germans especially. Oh, it is a real sad story. How shoddily their Schwärmerei for control was used by the folks in power. Paranoid Systems of History, PSH, a short-lived periodical of the 1920s whose plates have all mysteriously vanished, Netsch has even suggested in more than one editorial that the whole German inflation was created deliberately, simply to drive young enthusiasts of the cybernetic tradition into control work. After all, an economy inflating, upward bound as a balloon, its own definition of Earth's surface drifting upward in value, uncontrolled, drifting with the days, the feedback system expected to maintain the value of the mark constant, having humiliatingly failed. Unity gain around the loop, unity gain, zero change, and hush, that way, forever, these were the secret rhymes of the childhood of the discipline of control. Secret and terrible, as the Scarlet Histories say. Diverging oscillations of any kind were nearly the worst threat. You could not pump the swings of these playgrounds higher than a certain angle from the vertical. Fights broke up quickly, with a smoothness that had not been long in coming. Rainy days never had much lightning or thunder to them, only a haughty glass grayness collecting in the lower parts. A monochrome overlook of valleys crammed with mossy deadfalls, jabbing roots at heaven not entirely in malign playfulness, as some white surprise for the elitists up there paying no mind. No. Valleys thick with autumn, and in the rain, a withering, spinsterish brown behind the gold of it. Very selectively blighted rainfall teasing you across the lots and into the back streets, which grow ever more mysterious and badly paved and more deeply platted, lot giving way to crooked lot 7 times and often more, around angles of hedge, across freaks of the optical daytime until we have passed, fevered, silent, out of the region of streets itself, and into the countryside, into the quilted, dark fields and the wood, the beginning of the true forest, where a bit of the ordeal ahead starts to show, and our hearts to feel afraid. But just as no swing could ever be thrust above a certain height, so, beyond a certain radius, the forest could be penetrated no further. A limit was always there to be brought to. It was so easy to grow up under that dispensation. All was just as wholesome as could be. Edges were hardly ever glimpsed, much less flirted at or with. Destruction, oh, and demons, yes, including Maxwell's, were there deep in the woods with other beasts vaulting among the earthworks of your safety. So was the rocket's terrible passage reduced, literally, to bourgeois terms. Terms of an equation such as that elegant blend of philosophy and hardware, abstract change and hinged pivots of real metals which describes motion under the aspect of your control. Theta times d square phi dt square plus delta asterisk d phi dt plus partial derivative of L over partial derivative of alpha times s sub 1 minus s sub 2 times alpha equals minus partial derivative of R over partial derivative of beta times S sub 3 times beta. Preserving, possessing, steering between Scylla and Charybdis the whole way to Brenschluss. If any of the young engineers saw correspondence between the deep conservatism of feedback and the kinds of lives they were coming to lead in the very process of embracing it, it got lost or disguised. None of them made the connection, at least not while alive. It took death to show it to Roland Feldspath, death with its very good chances for being too late, and a host of other souls feeling themselves, even now, rocket-like, driving out toward the stone-blue lights of the vacuum under a control they cannot claim. The illumination out here is surprisingly mild. Mild as heavenly robes, a feeling of population and invisible force, fragments of voices, glimpses into another order of being. Afterwards, Fafnir would be left not so much with any clear symbol or scheme to it as with some alkaline aftertaste of lament, an irreducible strangeness, a self-sufficiency nothing could get inside. Yes, sort of German, these episodes here. Well, these days, Slothrop is even dreaming in the language. Folks have been teaching him dialects. Plattdeutsch for the zone the British plan to occupy. Thuringian, if the Russians happen not to drive as far as Nordhausen, where the central rocket works is located. Along with the language teachers come experts in ordnance, electronics, and aerodynamics. And a fellow from Shell International Petroleum named Hilary Bounce, who was going to teach him about propulsion. It seems that early in 1941, the British Ministry of Supply let a 10,000-pound research contract to Shell, wanted Shell to develop a rocket engine that would run on something besides cordite, which was being used in those days to blow up various sorts of people at the rate of oodles and oodles of tons an hour, and couldn't be spared for rockets. A team, ramrodded by one Isaac Lubach, set up a static test facility at Langhurst near Horsham and began to experiment with liquid oxygen and aviation fuel, running their first successful test in August of 42. Engineer Lubach was a double first at Cambridge and the father of British liquid oxygen research, and what he didn't know about the sour stuff wasn't worth knowing. His chief assistant these days is Mr. Geoffrey Gollan, and it is to Gollan that Hilary Bounce reports. "Well, I'm an SO man myself," Slothrop thinks he ought to mention. "My old short was a gas gobbler, all right, but a gourmet. Any time it used that shell, I had to drop a whole bottle of that bromo in the tank just to settle that poor fucking terraplane's plumbing down." "Actually," the eyebrows of Captain Bounce, a 110% company man, going up and down earnestly to help him out, "we handled only the transport and storage end of things then. In those days before the Japs and the Nazis, you know, production and refining were up to the Dutch office at The Hague." Slothrop, poor sap, is remembering Katja. Lost Katja, saying the name of her city, whispering Dutch love words as they moved down sea mornings, now another age, another dispensation. "Wait a minute. That's Batavsche Petroleum Maatschappij NV?" "Right. It's also the negative of a Recco photograph of the city, dark brown, festooned with water spots, never enough time to let these dry out completely. Are you blokes aware?" They're trying to teach him English, English too, heaven knows why, and it keeps coming out like Cary Grant. "That Jerry, old Jerry, you know, has been in that, the Hague there, shooting his bloody rockets at that London, eh, and using the Royal Dutch Shell headquarters building at the Yosef Israel plane, if I remember correctly, for a radio guidance transmitter. What bizarre shit is that, old man?" Bounce stares at him, jingling his gastric jewelry, not knowing what to make of Slothrop exactly. "I mean," Slothrop now working himself into a fuss over something that only disturbs him, dimly, "nothing to kick up a row over, is it? Doesn't it strike you as just a bit odd, you Shell chaps working on your liquid engine, your side of the channel, you know, and their chaps firing their bloody things at you with your own blasted Shell transmitter tower, you see?" "No, I can't see that it makes... What are you getting at? Surely they'd simply have picked the tallest building they could find that's in a direct line from their firing sites to London." "Yes, and at the right distance, too, don't forget that. Exactly 12 kilometers from the firing site, hey? That's exactly what I mean." "Wait, oh, wait, is that what he means?" "Well, I'd never thought of it that way." "Neither have I, Jackson. Oh, me neither, folks." Hilary Bounce and his puzzled smile. Another innocent, a low-key enthusiast like Sir Stephen Dodson Truck, but proverbs for paranoids, too. The innocence of the creatures is in inverse proportion to the immortality of the master. "I hope I haven't said anything wrong." "Why is that?" "You look
Bounce, aspirating what he means to be a warm little laugh. Worried. Worried, all right, by the jaws and teeth of some creature. Some presence so large that nobody else can see it. There. That's that monster I was telling you about. That's no monster, stupid. That's clouds. No, can't you see? It's his feet. Well, Slothrop can feel this beast in the sky. Its visible claws and scales are being mistaken for clouds and other plausibilities, or else everyone has agreed to call them other names when Slothrop is listening. It's only a wild coincidence, Slothrop. He will learn to hear quote marks in the speech of others. It is a bookish kind of reflex. Maybe he's genetically predisposed. All those earlier Slothrops packing Bibles around the Blue Hilltops as part of their gear, memorizing chapter and verse, the structures of arcs, temples, visionary thrones, all the materials and dimensions, data behind which always, nearer or farther, was the numinous certainty of God. Well, what more appropriate way for Tyrone to get it one cold morning than this? It's a blueprint of a German parts list, reproduced so crummy he can hardly read the words. Vorrichtung für die Isolierung 0011-5565/43. Now what's this? He knows the number by heart. It's the original contract number for the A4 rocket as a whole. What's an insulation device doing with the aggregate's contract number and a DE rating, too, the highest Nazi priority there is? Not good. Either a clerk at OKW fucked up, which is not unheard of, or else he just didn't know the number and put the rockets in as the next best thing. Claim, part and work numbers all have the same flag note, which directs Slothrop to a document SG-1. Flag note on the flag note says, Geheime Kommandosache. This is a state secret in the meaning of Section 35, R5138. Say, he greets General Wyvern, nipping in through the door. I'd like to get a hold of a copy of that document, SG-1. Ha, replies the General. So would our chaps, I imagine. Quit fooling. Every piece of Allied intelligence on the A4, however classified, gets stuffed into a secret funnel back in London and all comes out in Slothrop's fancy cell at the casino. So far they've held back nothing. Slothrop, there are no SG documents. First impulse is to rattle the parts list in the man's face. But today, he is the shrewd Yankee foxing the redcoats. Oh, well, maybe I read it wrong. Making believe look around the paper-littered room. Maybe it was a 56 or something. Jeepers, it was just here. The general goes away again, leaving Slothrop with a puzzle, kind of a, well, not an obsession, really. Not yet. Opposite the parts listing, over in the materials column now, here's Imipolex G. Oh, really? Insulation device made of Imipolex G, huh? He kicks around the room looking for his handbook of German trade names, nothing even close to it there. He locates next a master materials list for the A4 and all its support equipment, and there's sure no Imipolex G in that either. Scales and claws, and footfalls no one else seems to hear. Something wrong? Hillary Bounce again, with his nose in the doorway. It's about this liquid oxygen. Need some more of that specific impulse data there. Specific? Do you mean specific thrust? Oops, thrust. English to the rescue. Bounce diverted. For lox and alcohol, it's about 200. What more do you need to know? But didn't you chaps use petrol at Langhurst? Among other things, yes. Well, it's about those other things. Don't you know there's a war on? You can't be proprietary about stuff like that. But all our company reports are back in London. Perhaps my next time out... Shit, this red tape. I need it now, Captain. He goes around assuming they've assigned him a limitless need to know, and Bounce confirms it. I could send back by teletype, I suppose. Now you're talking. Teletype? Yes, Hillary Bounce has his own private Shell International Network teletype rig or terminal, just what Slothrop was hoping for, right in his hotel room, back in the closet behind a rack of all-kit uniforms and stiff shirts. Slothrop finesses his way in with the help of his friend Michelle, whom he's noticed Bounce has an eye on. Howdy, babe, up in a brown stocking-hung garret where the dancing girls sleep. How'd you like to get fixed up with a big oil man tonight? Some language problem here. She's thinking of getting connected through metal fittings to a gross man dripping somehow with crude oil, a sex angle she's not sure she'd enjoy, but they get that one straightened out, and presently Michelle is raring to go sweet-talk the man away from his teletype long enough for Slothrop to get on to London and ask about Imipolex G. Indeed, she has noted Captain Bounce now and then among her nightly admirers, noted in particular an item of belly brass that Slothrop's seen too. A gold benzene ring with a Formé cross in the center. The I.G. Farben Award for Meritorious Contributions to Synthetics Research. Bounce got that one back in 32. The industrial liaison, it suggests, was indeed dozing at the bottom of Slothrop's mind when the rocket guidance transmitter question arose. It has even, in a way, inspired the present teletype plot. Who'd know better than an outfit like Shell, with no real country, no side in any war, no specific face or heritage, tapping instead out of that global stratum most deeply laid from which all the appearances of corporate ownership really spring. Okay. Now, there is a party tonight over on the Cap, chez Raoul de la Palimpepin, young madcap heir of the Limoges fireworks magnate, Georges Poudre de la Palimpepin, if party is the word for something that's been going on non-stop ever since this piece of France was liberated. Slothrop is allowed, under the usual surveillance, to drop in to Raoul's whenever the mood strikes him. It's a giddy, shiftless crowd out there. They drift in from all corners of Allied Europe, linked by some network of family, venery, and a history of other such parties whose complexity his head's never quite been able to fit around. Here and there, faces will go by, old American faces from Harvard or from Schaff, names he's lost. They are revenants, maybe accidental, maybe... It is to this party that Michelle has seduced Hilary Bounce, and for which Slothrop, soon as his reply from London has come nattering through, in clear, on Bounce's machine, now proceeds to dude himself up for. He'll read the information through later, singing, "With my face shined up like a microphone, and a stay comb on my hair, I'm just as suave as an ice cream cone, say I'm Mr. Debonair." And turned out in a green French suit of wicked cut with a subtle purple check in it, broad-flowered tie, one at the Trente de Quarante table, brown and white wingtip shoes with golf cleats and white socks. Slothrop tops off now with a midnight blue snap-brim fedora and is away clickety-clack out the foyer of the Casino Hermann Göring, looking sharp. As he exits, a wiry civilian, disguised as the Secret Service's notion of an Apache, eases away from a niche in the porte-cochere and follows Slothrop's cab out the winding dark road to Raoul's party. Turns out some merrymaker has earlier put 100 grams of hashish in the hollandaise. Word of this has got around. There has been a big run on broccoli. Roasts lie growing cold on the room-long buffet tables. A third of the company are already asleep, mostly on the floor. It is necessary to thread one's way among bodies to get to where anything's happening. What's happening is not clear. There are the usual tight little groups out in the gardens, dealing. Not much spectacle tonight. A homosexual triangle has fizzed over into pinches and recriminations, so as to block the door to the bathroom. Young officers are outside, vomiting among the zinnias. Couples are wandering, girls abound, velvet-bowed, wild-sleeved, underfed, broad-shouldered, and permed, talking in half a dozen languages, sometimes brown from the sun here, others pale as death's vicar from more eastern parts of the war. Eager young chaps with patent leather hair rush about trying to vamp the ladies, while older heads with no hair at all prefer to wait, putting out only minimal effort, eyes and mouths across the rooms talking business in the meantime. One end of the salon is occupied by a dance band, and an emaciated crooner with wavy hair and very red eyes who is singing, "Julia, Foxtrot." "Julia, would you think me peculiar if I should fool you into giving me just a little kiss? Julia, no one else could love you trulier. How I'd worship and bejule you if you'd only give me just a little kiss. Ah, Julia, my poor heart grows unrulier. No one oolier or droolier could I be longing for. What's more, Julia, I would shout hallelujah to have my Julia in my arms forevermore."
saxophony and Park Lane kind of tune, perfect for certain states of mind. Slothrop sees Hilary Bounce, clearly a victim of the hallucinogenic hollandaise, nodded out on a great puff with Michelle, who's been fondling his I.G. Farben trinket for the past 2 or 3 hours. Slothrop waves, but neither one notices him. Dopers and drinkers struggle together without shame at the buffet and in the kitchens, ransacking the closets, licking out the bottoms of casseroles. A nude bathing party passes through on the way down the sea steps to the beach. Our host, that Raoul, is roaming around in a 10-gallon hat, Tom Mix shirt and brace of 6 guns, with a Percheron horse by the bridle. The horse is leaving turds on the Bukhara rug, also on the odd supine guest. It is all out of shape, no focus to it until a sarcastic flourish from the band, and here comes the meanest customer Slothrop has seen outside of a Frankenstein movie. Wearing a white zoot suit with reet pleats and a long gold keychain that swings in flashing loops as he crosses the room with a scowl for everybody, in something of a hurry but taking the time to scan faces and bodies, head going side to side, methodical, a little ominous. He stops at last in front of Slothrop, who's putting together a Shirley Temple for himself. You! A finger the size of a corn cob, an inch from Slothrop's nose. You bet! Slothrop dropping a maraschino cherry on the rug, then squashing it as he takes a step backward. I'm the man, all right, sure. What is it? Anything? Come on. They proceed outside to a eucalyptus grove where Jean-Claude Gong, notorious white slaver of Marseille, is busy white slaving. Hey, you! Hollering into the trees. You want to be a white slave, huh? Shit, no, answers some invisible girl. I want to be a green slave. Magenta, yells somebody from up in an olive tree. Vermilion. Think I'll take up dealing dope, says Jean-Claude. Look, Slothrop's friend, producing a craft paper envelope that even in the gloom, Slothrop can tell is fat with American Army yellow seal script. I want you to hold this for me till I ask for it back. It looks like Italo is going to get here before tomorrow, and I'm not sure which one. At this rate, tomorrow's going to get here before tonight, Slothrop interjects in a Groucho Marx voice. Don't try to undermine my confidence in you, advises the large one. You're the man. Right, Slothrop tucking envelope inside pocket. Say, where'd you get that zoot you're wearing there? What's your size? 42, medium? You shall have one. And so saying, he rumbles off back inside. Hey, and a sharp keychain, Slothrop calls after. What the heck's going on? He wanders around asking a question or two. The fella turns out to be Blodgett Waxwing, well-known escapee from the Caserne Martier in Paris, the worst stockade in the ETO. Waxwing's specialty is phonying documents of various sorts, PX ration cards, passports, soldbücher, whilst dealing in army hardware, also as a sideline. He has been AWOL off and on since the Battle of the Bulge, and with a death rap for that over his head, he still goes into U.S. Army bases at night to the canteens to watch the movies, provided they're westerns. He loves those shit-kickers, the sound of hoofbeats through a metal speaker across 100 yards of oil drums and deuce and a half ruts in the foreign earth makes his heart stir as if a breeze blew there. He's got some of his many contacts to run him off a master schedule of every movie playing in every occupation town in the theater, and he's been known to hotwire a general's jeep just to travel up to that Poitiers for the evening to see a good old Bob Steele or Johnny Mac Brown. His picture may hang prominently in all the guardrooms and be engraved in thousands of Snowdrop's brains, but he has seen The Return of Jack Slade 27 times. The story here tonight is a typical World War II romantic intrigue, just another evening at Raoul's place, involving a future opium shipment being used by Tamara as security against a loan from Italo, who in turn owes Waxwing for a Sherman tank his friend Theophile is trying to smuggle into Palestine, but must raise a few £1,000 for purposes of bribing across the border, and so has put the tank up as collateral to borrow from Tamara, who is using part of her loan from Italo to pay him. End of side 8. Chain side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. Side 9. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 287. But meantime, the opium deal doesn't look like it's going to come through because the middleman hasn't been heard from in several weeks. Along with the money, Tamara fronted him, which she got from Raoul de la Perlimpinpin through Waxwing, who is now being pressured by Raoul for the money because Italo, deciding the tank belongs to Tamara now, showed up last night and took it away to an undisclosed location as payment on his loan, thus causing Raoul to panic. Something like that. Clothrop's tale is being made indecent propositions by two of the homosexuals who've been fighting in the bathroom. Bounce and Michelle are nowhere in sight, and neither is that Waxwing. Raoul is talking earnestly to his horse. Clothrop is just settling down next to a girl in a pre-war Worth frock and with a face like Peniel's Alice. Same forehead, nose, hair, when from outside comes this most god-awful clanking, snarling, crunching of wood. Girls come running terrified out of the eucalyptus trees and into the house, and right behind them what comes crashing now into the pallid lights of the garden but, why, the Sherman tank itself. Headlights burning like the eyes of King Kong, treads spewing grass and pieces of flagstone as it maneuvers around and comes to a halt. Its 75-millimeter cannon swivels until it's pointing through the French windows right down into the room. Antoine, a young lady focusing in on the gigantic muzzle, for heaven's sake, not now. A hatch flies open, and Tamara, Slothrop guesses, wasn't Italo supposed to have the tank, emerges shrieking to denounce Raoul, Waxwing, Italo, Theophile, and the middleman on the opium deal. But now, she screams, I have you all, one coup de foudre. The hatch drops. Oh, Jesus, there's a sound of a 3-inch shell being loaded into its breech. Girls start to scream and make for the exits. Dopers are looking around, blinking, smiling, saying yes in a number of ways. Raoul tries to mount his horse and make his escape, but misses the saddle and slides all the way over, falling into a tub of black market jello, raspberry flavor with whipped cream on top. Oh, no, Slothrop having about decided to make a flanking run for the tank when, Iblam! The cannon lets loose an enormous roar, flame shooting 3 feet into the room, shockwave driving eardrums into middle of brain, blowing everybody against the far walls. The drape has caught fire. Flothrop, tripping over partygoers, can't hear anything, knows his head hurts, keeps running through the smoke at the tank, leaps on, goes to undog the hatch, and is nearly knocked off by Tamara popping up to holler at everybody again. After a struggle which shouldn't be without its erotic moments, for Tamara is a swell-enough-looking twist with some fine moves, Slothrop manages to get her in a come-along and drag her down off of the tank. But loud noise and all, look, he doesn't seem to have an erection. This is a datum London never got, because nobody was looking. Turns out the projectile, a dud, has only torn holes in several walls and demolished a large allegorical painting of virtue and vice in an unnatural act. Virtue had one of those dim, faraway smiles. Vice was scratching his shaggy head, a little bewildered. The burning drape's been put out with champagne. Raoul is in tears, thankful for his life, wringing Slothrop's hands and kissing his cheeks, leaving trails of jello wherever he touches. Tamar is escorted away by Raoul's bodyguards. Slothrop has just disengaged himself and is wiping the jello off of his suit when there is a heavy touch on his shoulder. You were right. You are the man. That's nothing, Errol Flynn frisks his mustache. I saved a dame from an octopus not so long ago. How about that? With one difference, says Blodgett Waxwing. This really happened tonight, but that octopus didn't. How do you know? I know a lot. Not everything, but a few things you don't. Listen, Slothrop, you'll be needing a friend, and sooner than you think. Don't come here to the villa. It may be too hot by then, but if you can make it as far as Nice... He hands over a business card embossed with a chestnut and an address on Rue Rossini. I'll take the envelope back. Here's your suit. Thanks, brother. He's gone. His talent is just to fade when he wants to. The zoot suit is in a box tied with a purple ribbon. Keychains there, too. They both belong to a kid who used to live in East Los Angeles named Ricky Gutierrez. During the zoot suit riots in 1943, young Gutierrez was set upon by a carload of Anglo vigilantes from Whittier, beaten up while the L.A. police watched and called out advice, then arrested for disturbing the peace. The judge was allowing zoot suitors to choose between jail and the army. Gutierrez joined up, was wounded on Saipan, developed gangrene,
had to have his arm amputated, is home now, married to a girl who works in a kitchen at a taco place in San Gabriel, can't find any work himself, drinks a lot during the day. But his old zoot and those of thousands of others busted that summer, hanging empty on the backs of all the Mexican L.A. doors, got bought up and have found their way over here, into the market, no harm turning a little profit, is there? They'd only have hung there in the fat smoke and the baby smell, in the rooms with shades pulled down against the white sun beating day after day on the dried palm trees and muddy culverts inside these fly-ridden and empty rooms.
Imipolex G has proved to be nothing more or less sinister than a new plastic, an aromatic heterocyclic polymer developed in 1939, years before its time, by one L. Jampf for I.G. Farben. It is stable at high temperatures, like up to 900 degrees centigrade. It combines good strength with a low power loss factor. Structurally, it's a stiffened chain of aromatic rings, hexagons like the gold one that slides and taps above Hillary Bounce's navel, alternating here and there with what are known as heterocyclic rings. The origins of Imipolex G are traceable back to early research done at DuPont. Plasticity has its grand tradition and mainstream, which happens to flow by way of DuPont and their famous employee, Carruthers, known as the Great Synthesist. His classic study of large molecules spanned the decade of the 20s and brought us directly to nylon, which not only is a delight to the fetishist and a convenience to the armed insurgent, but was also, at the time and well within the system, an announcement of plasticity's central canon, that chemists were no longer to be at the mercy of nature. They could decide now what properties they wanted a molecule to have and then go ahead and build it. At DuPont, the next step after nylon was to introduce aromatic rings into the polyamide chain. Pretty soon a whole family of aromatic polymers had arisen. Aromatic polyamides, polycarbonates, polyethers, polysulfanes. The target property most often seemed to be strength. First among plasticity's virtuous triad of strength, stability, and whiteness. Kraft, Standfestigkeit, Weisse. How often these were taken for Nazi graffiti, and indeed how indistinguishable they commonly were on the rain-brightened walls as the buses clashed gears in the next street over, and the trams creaked of metal, and the people were mostly silent in the rain, with the early evening darkened to the texture of smoke from a pipe, and the arms of young passers-by not in the sleeves of their coats, but inside somewhere as if sheltering midgets, or ecstatically drifted away from the timetable into a tactile affair with linings more seductive even than the new nylon. L. Jampf, among others, then proposed, logically, dialectically, taking the parental polyamide sections of the new chain and looping them around into rings too, giant heterocyclic rings to alternate with the aromatic rings. This principle was easily extended to other precursor molecules. A desired monomer of high molecular weight could be synthesized to order, bent into its heterocyclic ring, clasped, and strung in a chain along with the more natural benzene or aromatic rings. Such chains would be known as aromatic heterocyclic polymers. One hypothetical chain that Jampf came up with just before the war was later modified into Imipolex G. Jampf at the time was working for a Swiss outfit called Psychochemie AG,
originally known as the Grössli Chemical Corporation, a spin-off from Sandoz, where, as every schoolchild knows, the legendary Dr. Hoffmann made his important discovery.
In the early 20s, Sandoz, Siba, and Geigy had got together in a Swiss chemical cartel. Shortly after, Jampf's firm was also absorbed.
Apparently, most of Grössli's contract had been with Sandoz anyway. As early as 1926, there were real oral agreements between the Swiss cartel and IG Farben. When the Germans set up their cover company in Switzerland, IG Chemie, 2 years later, a majority of the Grössli stock was sold to them, and the company reconstituted as Psychochemie AG.
The patent for Imipolex G was thus cross-filed for both the IG and for Psychochemie. Shell Oil got into it through an agreement with Imperial Chemicals dated 1939. For some curious reason, Slothrop will discover, no agreements between ICI and the IG seem to be dated any later than 39. In this Imipolex agreement,
ICI could market the new plastic inside the Commonwealth in exchange for £1 and other good and valuable consideration. That's nice. Psychochemie AG is still around, still doing business at the same old address in the Schokoladestrasse in that Zurich, Switzerland. Frothrop swings the long keychain of his zoot in some agitation. A few things are immediately obvious. There is even more being zeroed in on him from out there than he'd thought, even in his most paranoid spells. Emipolex G shows up on a mysterious insulation device on a rocket being fired with the help of a transmitter on the roof of the headquarters of Dutch Shell, who is co-licensee for marketing the Emipolex, a rocket whose propulsion system bears an uncanny resemblance to one developed by British Shell at around the same time. And oh boy, it just occurs to Slothrop now where all the rocket intelligence is being gathered. Into the office of who but Mr. Duncan Sands, Churchill's own son-in-law, who works out of the Ministry of Supply, located where but at Shell Mech's house, for Christ's sake. Here Schlothrop stages a brilliant commando raid, along with faithful companion Bludgett Waxwing, on Shell Mech's house itself, right into the heart of the rocket's own branch office in London. Mowing down platoons of heavy security with his little Sten, kicking aside nubile and screaming rack secretaries, how else is there to react, even in play, savagely looting files, throwing Molotov cocktails, the zoot suit zanies at last crashing into the final sanctum with their trousers up around their armpits, smelling singed hair, spilled blood, to find not Mr. Duncan Sands cowering before their righteousness, nor open window, gypsy flight, scattered fortune cards, nor even a test of wills with the great consortium itself. But only a rather dull room. Business machines arrayed around the walls, calmly blinking. Files of cards pierced, frail as sugar faces, frail as the last German walls, standing without support after the bombs have been and now twisting high above, threatening to fold down out of the sky from the force of the wind that has blown the smoke away. The smell of firearms is in the air, and there's not an office dame in sight. The machines chatter and ring to each other. It's time to snap down your brims. Share a post-violent cigarette and think about escape. Do you remember the way in, all the twists and turns? No, you weren't looking. Any of these doors might open you to safety, but there may not be time. But Duncan Sands is only a name, a function in this how high does it go is not even the right kind of question to be asking, because the organization charts have all been set up by them, the titles and names filled in by them, because Proverbs for Paranoids 3. If they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about answers. Lothrop finds he has paused in front of the blue parts list that started all this. How high does it go? Ah. The treacherous question is not meant to apply to people, after all, but to the hardware. Squinting, moving a finger carefully down the columns, Lothrop finds that Vorrichtung für die Isolierung's next higher assembly, S. Gerät, 11/00000. If this number is the serial number of a rocket, as its form indicates, it must be a special model. Slothrop hasn't even heard of any with four zeros, let alone five, nor an S-Gerät either. There's an I-dash and a J-Gerät there in the guidance. Well, document SG-1, which isn't supposed to exist, must cover that. Out of the room. Going no place special, moving to a slow drumbeat in his stomach muscles. See what happens. Be ready. In the casino restaurant, not the slightest impedance at all to getting in, no drop in temperature perceptible to his skin, Slothrop sits down at a table where somebody has left last Tuesday's London Times. Hasn't seen one of them in a while. Leafing through, dum-dum-dee-doo, yeah, the war is still on, allies closing in east and west on Berlin, powdered eggs still going 1 in 3 a dozen, fallen officers, McGregor, Mucker Maffick, White Street, personal tributes. Meet me in St. Louis, showing at the Empire Cinema. Recalls doing the penis in the popcorn box routine there with one Madeline who was less than... Tantivy. Oh, shit, no, wait. True charm, humble-mindedness, strength of character, fundamental Christian cleanness and goodness. We all loved Oliver. His courage, kindness of heart, and unfailing good humor were an inspiration to all of us. Died bravely in battle, leading a gallant attempt to rescue members of his unit who were pinned down by German artillery. and signed by his most devoted comrade in arms, Theodore Bloat. Major Theodore Bloat now. Staring out the window, staring at nothing. Gripping a table knife so hard maybe some bones of his hand will break. It happens sometimes to lepers. Failure of feedback to the brain. No way to know how fiercely they may be making a fist. You know these lepers. Well, 10 minutes later, back up in his room, he's lying face down on the bed, feeling empty. Can't cry, can't do anything. They did it. Took his friend out to some death trap. Probably let him fake an honorable death and then just closed up his file. It will occur to him later that maybe the whole story was a lie. They could have planted it easy enough in that London Times, couldn't they? Left the paper for Slothrop to find. But by the time he figures that one out, there'll be no turning around. At noon, Hilary Bounce comes in, rubbing his eyes, wearing a shit-eating grin. How was your evening? Mine was remarkable. Glad to hear it, Slothrop is smiling. You're on my list too, pal. This smile asks from him more grace than anything in his languid American life ever has up till now. Grace he always imagined himself short on, but it's working. He's surprised, and so grateful that he almost starts crying then. The best part of all is not that Bounce appears fooled by the smile, but that Slothrop knows now that it will work for him again. So he does make it to Nice. After a fast escape down the Corniche, through the mountains fishtailing and rubber softly screeching at the sun-warmed abysses, tails all shaken back on the beach where he was thoughtful enough to lend his buddy Claude, the assistant chef, about the same height and build, his own brand-new pseudo-Tahitian bathing trunks, and while they're all watching that Claude find a black Citroën with the keys left in, nothing to it, folks, rolling into town in his white zoot, dark glasses, and a flopping Sydney Green Street Panama hat. He's not exactly inconspicuous among the crowds of military and the mamselles already shifted into summer dresses, but he ditches the car off Place Garibaldi, heads for a bistro on the old Nice side of La Porte Fosse, and takes time to nab a roll and coffee before setting out to find the address Waxwing gave him. It turns out to be an ancient four-story hotel with early drunks lying in the hallways, eyelids like tiny loaves brushed with the last glaze of setting sun and summertime dust and stately evolutions through the taupe light, summertime ease to the streets outside, April summertime as the great vortex of redeployment from Europe to Asia hoots past, leaving many souls each night to cling a bit longer to the tranquillities here. This close to the drain hole of Marseille, this next to last stop on the paper cyclone that sweeps them back from Germany, down the river valleys beginning to drag some from Antwerp and the northern ports too now as the vortex grows more sure as preferential paths are set up. Just for the knife edge, here in the Rue Rossini, there comes to Slothrop the best feeling dusk in a foreign city can bring. Just where the sky's light balances the electric lamplight in the street, just before the first star, some promise of events without cause, surprises, a direction at right angles to every direction his life has been able to find up till now. Too impatient to wait for the first star, Slothrop enters the hotel. The carpets are dusty, the place smells of alcohol and bleach. Sailors and girls come ambling through, together and separate, as Slothrop paranoid from door to door, looking for one that might have something to tell him. Radios play in the heavy wood rooms. The stairwell doesn't appear to be plumb, but tilted at some peculiar angle, and the light running down the walls is of only two colors, earth and leaf. Up on the top floor, Slothrop finally spots an old motherly femme de chambre on the way into a room carrying a change of linen, very white in the gloom. "Why did you leave?" the sad whisper ringing as if through a telephone receiver from someplace far away. "They wanted to help you. They wouldn't have done anything bad." Her hair is rolled up, George Washington style, all the way around. She gazes at 45 degrees to Slothrop, a patient park bench chess player's gaze, very large, arching, kindly nose and bright eyes. She is starch, sure-boned. The toes of her leather shoes turn up slightly. She's wearing red and white striped socks on enormous feet that give her the look of a helpful critter from one of the other worlds. The sort of elf who'd not only make shoes while you slept, but also sweep up a little, have the pot on when you awoke, and maybe a fresh flower by the window. "I beg your pardon?" "There's still time. You don't understand. They've killed a friend of mine."
But seeing it in the Times that way, so public, how could any of that be real? Real enough to convince him Tantivy won't just come popping in the door someday. Howdy, folks, and a bashful smile. Hey, Tantivy, where were you? Where was I, Sothoth? That's a good one. His smile lighting the time again and the world all free. He flashes Waxwing's card. The old woman breaks into an amazing smile, the two teeth left in her head under the night's new bulbs. She thumbs him upstairs and then gives him either the V for victory sign or some spell from distant countryside against the evil eye that sours the milk. Whichever it is, she is chuckling sarcastically. Upstairs is a roof, a kind of penthouse in the middle. Three young men with Apache sideburns and a young woman packing a braided leather sap are sitting in front of the entrance, smoking a thin cigarette of ambiguous odor. You are lost, mon ami. Out with Waxwing's card again. Ah, bien. They roll aside, and he passes into a bickering of canary-yellow borsellini. Cork-soled comic book shoes with enormous round toes. A lot of that saddle stitching and contrasting colors, such as orange on blue, and the perennial favorite green on magenta. Workaday groans of comforted annoyance commonly heard in public toilets. Telephone traffic inside clouds of cigar smoke. Waxwing isn't in, but a colleague interrupts some loud dealing soon as he sees the card. What do you need? Carte d'identité, passage to Zurich, Switzerland. Tomorrow. Place to sleep? The man hands over a key to one of the rooms downstairs. Do you have any money? Not much. I don't know when I could... Count, squint, riffle. Here. It's all right. It's not a loan. It comes out of overhead. Now, don't go outside, don't get drunk. Stay away from the girls who work here. See you tomorrow. Back to business. Sothrop's night passes uncomfortably. There is no position he can manage to sleep in for more than 10 minutes. The bugs sally out onto his body in skirmish parties, not uncoordinated with his level of wakefulness. Drunks come to the door, drunks and revenants. Roan, you've got to let me in. It's Dumpster, Dumpster Villard. What's that? It's really bad tonight. I'm sorry. I shouldn't impose this way. I'm more trouble than I'm worth. Listen, I'm cold. I've been a long way. A sharp knock. Dumpster. No, it's Murray Smile. I was next to you in Basic Company 84, remember? Our serial numbers are only 2 digits apart. I had to let Dumpster in. Where'd he go? Was I asleep? Don't tell him I was here. I just came to tell you. You don't have to go back. Really? Did they say it was all right? It's all right. Yeah, but did they say it was? Silence. Hey, Murray? Silence. The wind is blowing in the ironwork very strong, and down in the street a vegetable crate bounces end over end, wooden, empty, dark. It must be 4 in the morning. Got to get back. Shit, I'm late. No. Only a whisper, but it was her no that stayed with him. Who's that? Jenny? That you, Jenny? Yes, it's me. Oh, love, I'm so glad I found you. But I have to... Will they ever let her live with him at the casino? No, I can't. But what's wrong with her voice? Jenny, I heard your block was hit. Somebody told me the day after New Year's, a rocket, and I meant to go back and see if you were all right, but I just didn't. And then they took me to that casino. It's all right. But not if I didn't. Just don't go back to them. And somewhere, dark fish hiding past angles of refraction in the flow tonight are Katya and Tantivy, the two visitors he wants most to see. He tries to bend the voices that come to the door, bend them like notes on a harmonica, but it won't work. What he wants lies too deep. Just before dawn, knocking comes very loud, hard as steel. Slothrop has the sense this time to keep quiet. Come on, open up! MPs, open up! American voices, country voices, high-pitched and without mercy. He lies freezing, wondering if the bedsprings will give him away. For possibly the first time, he is hearing America as it must sound to a non-American. Later, he will recall that what surprised him most was the fanaticism, the reliance not just on flat force, but on the rightness of what they planned to do. He'd been told long ago to expect this sort of thing from Nazis, and especially from Japs. We were the ones who always played fair. But this pair outside the door now are as demoralizing as a close-up of John Wayne, the angle emphasizing how slanted his eyes are, funny you never noticed before, screaming, Banzai! Wait a minute, Ray, there he goes. Hopper, you asshole, come back here. You'll never get me in a straitjacket again. Hopper's voice goes fading around the corner as the MPs take off in pursuit. It dawns on Slothrop, literally, through the yellow-brown window shade, that this is his first day outside. His first free morning. He doesn't have to go back. Free? What's free? He falls asleep at last. A little before noon, a young woman let herself in with a passkey and leaves him the papers. He is now an English war correspondent named Ian Scuffling.
This is the address of one of our people in Zurich. Waxwing wishes you good luck and asks what kept you so long.
You mean he wants an answer?
He said you'd have to think about it.
Say,
it's just occurred to him, why are all you folks helping me like this, for free and all?
Who knows? We have to play the patterns. There must be a pattern you're in right now. But she's already left. Flothrop looks around the place. In the daylight, it's mean and anonymous. Even the roaches must be uncomfortable here. Is he off so quickly, like Katya on her wheel, off on a ratchet of rooms like this, to be in each one only long enough to gather wind or despair enough to move on to the next, but no way backward now ever again? No time even to get to know the Rue Rossini? Which faces holler from the windows? Where's a good place to eat? What's the name of the song everybody's whistling these